Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who, even though he's played for time, has nothing to say. It's Richard Herring. London! Oh no, I'm still drunk from last week. It's Richard Herring here. I'm doing my podcast, Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to Beau Brummel the other day, the dandy. The dandy guy who was very cool back in the old, in the day or whatever. Meant to research him on Wikipedia, find out when he was from. He calls it Rellisper, so that's going to be fun. We're going to talk to the audience. Nothing's happened to me since the last podcast, really hardly anything at all, and in the last week. So I'll talk to the... Hello there, young lady.
Hello.
I'm not talking to you. There was a clue in the young. And another clue in the lady. What's your name?
Rosie.
Rosie. Hello, Rosie. How are you doing? Did you come to see Rick Edwards last week? Is that why you're here? Yeah, thanks. That's all I wanted to know. What do you do for a living, Rosie?
I'm a civil servant.
You're a civil servant. How's that going for you with Brexit and everything going on? Pretty badly, right? Are you not allowed to say? People won't know who you are. Just, no one can see you from just Rosie. We'll call you something else. What department of civil service do you work in?
Housing.
Housing. Oh, that's all right. That's probably going to be... people will probably still be some houses afterwards. They're going to be a lot cheaper, aren't they? It's going to be good. As long as you don't own one at the moment. So, nice to see you. So, you know, look, it's unusual to have... I mean, what people usually look like in the front row. That's just why I wanted to say hello, because, you know, no offence, mate, but comparatively...
I have a science degree.
You have a science degree? That's good. It's good that you could nearly work in IT. Do you work in IT, mate? No, don't say no like you're above being in IT, mate. What do you work in? What's your name? Sorry.
Peter.
I was going to say you were hideously ugly before, but I didn't get to that bit. You're not Peter. You're very good looking in your own way.
Do you remember when you remember when you had some of this, Peter? Hey, do you remember? Hey, do you remember that? Look at that. I'm not. There's nothing. What do you do, Peter?
I work in a bank.
You work in a bank? Oh, it's his fault that everything's going wrong in the theatre, and he's sitting next to you. Which bank? Is it a good bank?
Oh, I'm not going to say that.
You're not. Coutts, isn't it? It's Coutts. Yes, it is. Yeah, I thought so. Do you work in a bank?
No.
What's your name?
Matt.
Oh God, I'm so drunk that I just nearly did a joke about you lying in front of a door. It's okay, I didn't do it, so it's okay. What'd you do, Matt?
I'm a lawyer.
You're a lawyer, fucking hell, it's high powered, isn't it? It's banks, civil servants. Where are my IT guys? There you are! How are you doing? IT? IT, there he is, the Dodgers shirt. What? How's the IT going? Yeah, good. That's what I'm. What's the best law, in your opinion? Which one do you like prosecuting people for or defending them for most?
There's so many to
choose. There are. That's why it's a difficult question. No, I ask the tough questions in this podcast, and I don't make it easy. But you know, if this is an example of your lawyering, mate, you should work in IT. Because it's no good. What's your best law? It's so difficult. What? Oh, this man's up for murder. It looks like he's done it. It's really difficult to get him off. I hope someone will come in with some evidence that proves he didn't do it. Is that what you do?
No.
Would you do that sort of stuff as a lawyer? No, it's a barrister. Right, well, it's lovely to talk to the audience in a slightly aggressive way. How are you, madam? I'm sorry I was a little rude earlier. I hope you didn't. I was only joking.
I'm sorry.
You don't have to apologise to me if I was rude to you.
I've been coming to see you for years.
Have you?
Years, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And just thought tonight I'll get really drunk and shout out.
and I've just got over cancer.
Oh, you just got over cancer? Well, that's good news.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, for you, for me, means you're going to be coming in and heckling. Yeah. I'm delighted. Congrats. Give this lady a round of applause. That's amazing. At last, some good news. Some good news. And as a comedian, it's a difficult one to deal with, isn't it? I've just got over cancer. Deal with that, you fucker. All right, I'm coming back at you. You're a lovely audience. Thank you very much. And please carry on being a lovely audience. Our guest tonight, this week. There was a lady like you in last week's audience. It was weird. So it's, Hello. Yeah, good. If I don't understand it, I don't have to respond. That's my rule. My guest this week is I know why you're here. He's best known as Roger Splodger, isn't he? In Grandpa, in Grandpa in My Pocket. Yeah, and we're going to talk about that for 1 hour. Will you please welcome the amazing Sanjeev Bhaskar, ladies and gentlemen. So wonderful to have you, Sanjeev. Thank you very much. Here he is. Oh, my God. He's such a busy man. I've been trying to get him on this podcast for many years, and here he is. It's very exciting to have you.
Thank you very much. I was saying this to you before, but I'll say it again. Not to you. I'll say it to you, because you've already heard it. It's really strange to be on a podcast that you listen to, because otherwise, you know, he's a disembodied voice most of the time, and now he's embodied, and that's just a bit strange.
And what a body it is that I've chosen to inhabit. Grandpa in My Pocket, do you remember much about work? James Bolam, of course.
James Bolam, yeah, he was the grandpa.
How did they shrink him down for that? How did they make him so small? Or do they make you really big?
No, they made him small.
Okay.
By rewashing him.
Okay.
Because there's a label stuck to James Bolam's neck,
yeah,
which says, do not tumble dry. So they tumble dried him.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's good.
That learned him.
It's a fun show.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, it was fun, yeah, for the kids and stuff. And
what did Roger Splodger do? I don't just remind people who don't watch it.
Everybody. Tell everybody what he did. Roger Splodger was, because it's a kids show.
Yes. Yeah,
it was a kids show.
Well, you know, adults are allowed to watch
it. Yeah, of course they
do.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. So he was a pervert that had escaped from. Oh, sorry, the text rather than the subtext. He was, as the name suggests, he was a painter.
Okay.
And he wasn't a very good painter, but he thought he was brilliant.
Yeah.
And so he just kind of like, you know, did some, you know, paint things that kids really love, like stepping in it and dropping it on his head and stuff like that.
Okay. And did you get to meet James Bolan? Were you working alongside him, or was he just in a different studio? Being
I wasn't. No, he was. He had his tiny trailer that he was in. No, I didn't. Well, I didn't do any scenes with him actually, but I did with, I think it was his missus.
Okay,
who was in it, and so I did scenes with her. It was lovely.
He's great, James Bolan. I tried to get him in my play, I Killed Rasputin, but he didn't want to do it. He preferred to be a small granddad in a pocket. That's fine. That is his choice.
Was it a tiny Rasputin?
It wasn't.
Because he was only doing tiny parts at that point.
It was a full-sized Felix Yusupov who was going to play, but yes, he didn't. Would you fancy a craft beer of some kind?
These are from Beer 52. What have you got here?
I've got a whole new batch this week. I've got Freak Scene, but they put the E in Freak back to front. That is how...
Oh, that's weirding me out.
Is that two? I'm going to have that one, because I'm a bit of a freak. There's Mrs. McCluskey...
Well, now, what is that? Is that Kavish? Savish?
Savish? Whatever you want. It's dry hopped wit beer with lime and coriander.
All
come
right.
on, that's for you.
Yeah,
that's
for,
come on.
Thank you, you racist bastards.
You like it, though, don't you? You like it.
Damn you, Herring. Damn you.
If I have a second beer, I might be drunk enough to try and roll out my attempt to do an Indian accent next. So,
drink up, Richard. Drink up.
Why is it okay to do a Welsh one and a Scottish one? And not...
Well, you can do a Welsh one, right?
I can, and that is basically...
You can do an Indian one.
My Welsh one is very, very, very Indian.
Go on, go on.
I'll do Welsh. Oh, hello! I am from Wales!
Or Punjab, depending on the part. I filmed in Wales, and there were times where, and I had to do an accent for that. It was a character who just arrived from India, and there were times when I wasn't sure whether I was doing a Welsh accent or not. And then the Welsh actors who were there, I wasn't sure whether they were doing an Indian accent. It's absolutely true. The series I did was set in the 60s. It was a daytime drama thing called The Indian Doctor. And I was in the kind of the three-piece suit and stuff, and I went to a co-op that was sort of around the corner. And there was a lady behind me in the queue. And she said, hello, Dr. Khan, is it? And I turned around and I said, hello. Well, no, it isn't. I'm playing a doctor. She said, I'm sorry. She said, you looked exactly like him. And I said, that's amazing. I said, is he your doctor? She said, well, he wasn't, and he died 20 years ago. That was real. That happened.
You know, it could be. You could have been the ghost of Dr. Khan. Maybe you are. We don't
in
know.
The co-op.
Yeah. They've still got a ghost still has to eat. So, what I didn't know about you and what's in that you only really started in entertainment and comedy in when you were about 34, is that
right? Yeah, that's right.
So, you worked in marketing for 10 years or so?
Yeah, I did a degree in business and marketing and then worked in you know, didn't have a proper job for 10 years until I started doing this. Yeah.
Right. Oh, did you work for IBM?
That was my first job.
Was it?
Yeah, IBM, yeah, in Hertfordshire.
Oh, was it? Oh, I did it. Me and Stu, very early on, did a, like, our friend Tony Brennan. Do you know Tony Brennan?
Yeah.
He used to work for IBM. He, do you know?
Yeah, this is one of those kind of...
Hey,
you're Richard, right? You live in England? You know Dave? You must do, right?
He's
London, right? Dave.
He's a great guy. He booked me and Stu to do a winter corporate on a boat for IBM. So we did, like, one of our first gigs was on a boat on the river, and I wondered if you'd been there.
No.
It was very snowy. I got off with a girl. It was great.
Obviously. Yeah, we all saw that.
I got up with a girl who worked for IBM, it was good. I stole someone's coat who worked for IBM, and then I felt guilty about it the next day and brought it back. I didn't have much respect for the people who worked for IBM because I thought I was poor and I thought they were all rich.
Yeah, but you still brought the coat back.
Well, I did, but I don't know if I went in a coat or whether I didn't go in a coat and then it was snowing.
I think it was a good plan not to go in a coat.
Yeah, and then you just take it.
Because then you just take it and you go, what? It's mine.
Yeah.
Well, do you think I'm an idiot? I'd come out in the snow without a coat.
I must have left the coat that I came in there or didn't have a coat. And if I didn't have a coat, then I can steal a coat from someone who works for IBM, let them go home in the snow, in the cold, while I kiss their person who works with them.
It's not exactly Ocean's 11, is
no,
it?
I mean,
it's close, but...
Then I felt guilty, and I pretended I'd taken it by accident. No one believed me.
Ah, redemption story.
No one believed me. Oh, well, it's a shame. I wondered if you'd been at that gig, and then you thought, hey, if those guys are doing comedy, anyone can. Were you doing anything? Were you doing... I mean, it says that you sort of realised you wanted to do comedy, but were you doing other comedy in the...
No, well, I was there's a now very successful composer, Nitin Sawhney, who does movies and stuff like that. So we started doing stuff together at college, and we would do, we didn't really understand how gigging worked. So we would spend about a month putting together a set and then do one show.
Right.
And then that would be it.
Yeah.
Then we'd do another one the following year. And then it was about 6 or 7 years later that I said to him, you know, you're not doing anything at the moment. I'm not. Why don't we get together and just, you know, come up with stuff and it'll be fun. And, you know, he was brilliant and still is a brilliant musician. So we had that musical kind of element to it. We were called the Secret Asians. And gives you an indication of how good the comedy was. And, yeah, we were doing one of these shows at the Oval House in London, in their studio theatres. It was 50-seater or something. And we got reviewed in Time Out, and we got this 5-star review.
From Bonnie Greer.
From Bonnie Greer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, playwright Bonnie Greer. And some producers from the BBC turned up and said, we're thinking of doing a sketch show, and this is the sort of material we're looking for. Would you be interested?
I mean, that's insane. I mean, it's great, but yeah, that's the kind of thing you sort
nuts.
Of dream of happening.
It
when
is
you
nuts.
Start going, I'll put on a show, and then a BBC...
Yeah, this is the plan.
And then we'll be on a successful BAFTA award.
What's your plan, son? To get really lucky. It'll never work.
But did I read somewhere that the producer tossed a coin as to whether they were going to come and see you? Is that true?
Yes. Well, the name of the show was Papa Don Preach. And... we were young, we were foolish, and yeah, they tossed a coin. They kind of said, this really sounds shit, and it was kind of, well, it's you know, it's 90 minutes, it was less than that, actually, it was about an hour and 15 minutes or something, so it was either we flip a coin and go to the pub, or we go and go to the show, and then we can still go to the pub, so
wow.
The coin turned up the right way for me.
It's insane!
It is nuts!
I mean, I'm sure it would have happened anyway, but it's kind of, it's crazy that... came together so
yeah, it
far.
Is. It is. Well, also, and I'm not sure if I've told anyone this before. This is one of those things where you get afterwards. You'll say, "Do you really want that?" So I was doing a TIE, theatre and education stuff, with a company called Tara Arts, which is based in London, and we were going around schools around the country doing sort of 40-minute Shakespeare plays for 8-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And I did one in North London. There was two of us, and we used masks and puppets and stuff like that. And there was a lady that came up to me after one of the shows. I used to improv in The Tempest, because they're 8 years old. You have to keep their sort of attention. And a lady came up to me afterwards, and she said, that was very funny. You know, all the improv stuff you were doing was very funny. And I said, thanks. And she said, do you do comedy? And I said, yeah. Bless you. And and she said, well, you know, on your own, are you stand up, or are you part of a duo? And I said, no, part of a duo. And she said, what are you called? And we didn't have a name, and we weren't doing anything at that point. And I said, we're called Secret Asians. That's a pun. And she went, oh, yeah, yeah. And she said, I've not seen you on the circuit, because I kind of watch the circuit and stuff. And I said, no, I said, we're keeping a low profile. I said... my friend is doing some music. I really wanted to work with kids, and so that's why I'm here. And she went, oh, that's really interesting. And I went and rang Nitin and said, I bullshitted some woman today after this thing, not realising that she was a journalist. And she wrote this up in The Independent.
Right.
And so then there was this article with me kind of going, yeah, you know, we're going to relaunch next year and all this kind of stuff. And then we had to do a gig. And so that's why we ended up doing the gig.
Incredible.
A life
just,
of lies.
Everyone's just lucky, and everyone's just luck. Just luck. it's great. And goodness gracious me, how can you go to a restaurant at any point in your life without people saying the one thing to you that they must say to you all the time?
And what might that be?
About having an English.
Yes.
Does that ever come up still?
Do you know what? It's really interesting. On Twitter, people... one of the lines in the sketch was, you know, what is the blandest thing on the menu?
Yeah.
Give me the blandest thing on the menu. And somebody sent me a tweet not that long ago, actually, and they were on an airline, and I can't remember which one, but it's one of the options was European cuisine, in brackets, bland. They must have racked their brains going, how do we describe this? Do you describe meat? No, it's a salt, not really salt, sweet. No, it's really bland. It's bland. And this was printed up on a menu card.
I mean, there was lots of great sketches in, goodness gracious me, but that one did, like, resonate with people.
Yeah, that became our flagship sketch, and it kind of, I suppose, set out our stall, if we had a stall. That's not too much of a stereotype. In the shop. It kind of, you know, it was a reversal sketch and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, the four of us that wrote, so Mira, my missus, and I, Sharat Sadana and Richard Pinto were the four main writers. And we were just all into comedy. So we'd kind of watch stuff. We were watching stuff at the time. And so you get influenced by everything. But it was Richard and Sharat that came up with with that sketch mainly.
Yeah, it's and do people still shout at you? Because I'm going to do all for the rest of the interview.
Are you?
No, I'm not. Yeah, but does it haunt you and follow you like sometimes those things can, or have people?
No, do you know what? It's 20 years since we did it, since it first came on TV, and we did three series, and it's really humbling, actually, that people still remember it with such fondness. And the strange thing is that a lot of people now have found it on sort of YouTube clips and stuff like that. I don't think it's aged that badly. You know,
no,
there was some of it obviously has, but actually a lot of the sketches still kind of work. And so it is humbling that people still remember it fondly, and that's nice.
It's great. And the Kumars came after that. How long after? Goodness Gracious Me, was it? You did a couple of series of Goodness Gracious Me.
On our recording day today, it was exactly to this day 17 years ago.
Right.
So it was 2001, this date.
Okay.
We're
not going to tell you what date that is.
No, we're not. No. None of your fucking business. But I had the idea about 5 years earlier, and everybody turned it down.
Right.
And I remember somebody at one of the main channels who I met with who said, so what is this idea you've got? And I said, well, look, it's this family, and they interview real guests, and, you know, he's got his grandmother and his parents there, and it'll just be good because you've got an older person asking questions and you've got an older woman asking questions, which, you know, a young guy can't ask and everything. And he went, yeah. He said, you know what would be really good? And I said, yeah. And he said, if the main interviewer was a woman, a young woman. And I said, oh, okay. Well, I was thinking of playing the interview, but let's hear it. And he said, and the reason that the guests turn up every week is because she's got great tits. Oh, can you believe this? And I kind of, and this was somebody involved in diversity at that channel. And I remember kind of, we were in a pub, and I just said, right, anyway, that's your idea, so good luck with that. I picked up my bit of A4 paper and I left.
Yeah.
So I had that for sort of 4 or 5 years.
Right, and it was based on the reality of your home life with your mother and father, is that true?
Well, it was based on a particular incident, yeah. There was a girlfriend, Jeanette, who I took home to meet my parents. It was the first time I'd taken a girl home to meet my parents, so I was kind of quite nervous about it. And we walked in through the door and I said, Jeanette, this is my mum, this is my dad, mum, dad, this is Jeanette. And my dad said, pleased to meet you. How much does your father earn? And I said, Dad, you can't ask that. He said, it's only a question. She doesn't have to answer it. And I said, well, keep your voice down. It's no. And then my mum, voice of reason, stepped in and said, ignore him, Jeanette. It's very nice to meet you. You know, Sanjeev has always been terrible at handling rejection. And it was kind of like, it's the first 30 seconds. And so when we started doing Goodness Gracious Me, I remember sitting in my room that I rented in South London at that time, and I thought, God, I wonder if I ever meet anyone famous. And I thought, gosh, I wonder what would happen if I introduced them to my parents. And I thought, no different. That's it.
Yeah.
And what was lovely was that my parents came to see a lot of the recordings, and I remember after the who did we have on? We had Helena Bonham Carter was on, and there'd be a green room thing afterwards, and I introduced Helena to my mum. I said, Helena, this is my real mum. And Helena said, "Oh, it's lovely to meet you." And my mum said, she said, you're such a pretty face you have. And she said, "Oh, thank you." She said, "Why in the last film did they make you a monkey face?" Which was the Planet of the Apes film had come out. And it was kind of like... Mini Driver. Yeah. Mini Driver had said that, you know, she was living in Los Angeles now and she doesn't live in London anymore. And my parents said, "We live quite near the airport and we have a Zed bed." And say, "If you ever need to start off..." So they were doing that anyway. But yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty cool interactive experience where you do the show and then you come back and meet the real people.
they were not based on.
But
you just reminded me, there was on the first show we did, it was Richard E. Grant and Michael Parkinson. And my dad, before the show, had said, "Can I invite someone?" And I said, "Who?" And he said, "Well, just... can I invite someone?" I said, "Well, it depends on who it is, Dad. I mean, who are you thinking of inviting?" He said, "I don't know. I haven't asked anyone yet. I don't know if they're available." And I said, "But I'd like to know who you're bringing to the show." And he said, "I don't know." And I said, "Look, you can bring anyone except Uncle Surrender, all right? Because Uncle Surrender always kind of just gets involved. And also, he has the largest turban in history. It was like the motherships in Independence Day. But..." And he said, no, of course not. So, you know, you go on to do the show. I walk on to say hello to the audience first. First thing I notice, row three, fucking, you know, mothership with Uncle Surrender underneath it, dangling underneath his turban. And so it became, like someone who's got a boil or something. You know, my eyes just drifted back to this huge turban. And afterwards, I was dreading him kind of like approaching either Richard E. Grant or Michael Parkinson and everything. And I said to my dad, I just keep him in the corner here. Let him have his kind of like, you know, glass of pop or whatever. And I was talking to Michael Parkinson. And as I'm talking to him, I see this shadow fall over Parky's face. And I just thought, oh, no. And then I heard a, "Mr. Parkinson!" And it was kind of like, "I told you, Dad."
I think it works, though, because, I mean, obviously it worked for lots of reasons, very beautifully put together, but it's just like any family. Even though it was an Asian family and there was those things in it, that's just like my mum and dad as well.
I think comedy, is most potent when there's universality in it. I mean, I think it's most interesting when it's, specific.
Yeah.
But within that specificity, you kind of hit all these things that are universal. And interestingly enough, the Kumar's shown around the world, it was everywhere around the world, it was a British comedy.
Right.
Except here. In Britain, it was an Asian comedy. But everywhere else, I remember a review in, San Jose Sentinel or some paper in America, that said, they said, "We have no idea who the guests are. Eamon Holmes, we have no idea what is an Eamon Holmes." But they said, we get the fact that it's a family. We get that, you know, that the son is spoilt and the grandmother's a loose cannon and stuff like that. So, I am pleased with that. I am proud of it.
And it's interesting that, I mean, that's, again, I find celebrity a fascinating thing. But what's amazing is when, the veil falls away. And Eamon Holmes in America is just a bloke. That's just why you're talking about a bloke. Talking Cock was sort of done all over Europe and by different people in different languages, a stand-up show I did. And there was a big opening in Norway, I think. And I went to this opening in Norway and all these people walking in all these glamorous clothes and the kind of old guy with espadrilles on. Everyone's going, "Oh," and you think, when you don't know who any of them are, it's just... what? It's just an old bloke. Why has he got an 18-year-old girlfriend? How's this working? It's insane. So you got, there's this sort of veneer of celebrity, which is interesting. And I guess you're choosing. I mean, you had obviously big stars on that show, but you're choosing interesting people to talk to that you know are going to be.
But you picked up on exactly what was behind my kind of idea of making it in the first place, or coming up with it, which was that, the moment they came through the front door and were confronted by a family, they could only be themselves. There was, that veneer of whatever celebrity was for them was absolutely stripped away. When you've got somebody who's older saying, "Do you want a cup of tea? Do you want a biscuit? Do you want a samosa? Have you eaten samosas? Do you like samosas? Is it too hot for you?" And so there was lots of domestics that were in there. And I think it's very difficult when you've been involved in something, but I think it was quite disarming.
No, definitely.
But I think you certainly saw a different side to a celebrity.
Yeah, and you'd worked with Mira for a long time before you became romantically involved. Was it seeing
her... 3 years.
Yeah, was it seeing her dressed up as a grandma that did it for you? Was that the...
Do you know what? I realised that there were no surprises for me coming up in 50 or 60 years. I just turned around and go, ah, there you are. She was the most reluctant person of the cast to do it.
I thought she was going to say to ever go out and ever get romantically involved with me. But
ever put the teeth in when we had sex.
Really?
Yeah, because she initially said, do I want to just be known for playing an old lady and stuff? And I said, well, what makes you think the show's going to be a success anyway? But also, I knew that I couldn't think of anybody else who could improvise as well. And that was the thing that particularly Mira and myself needed to be able to improv. And we got to the stage where, we knew when the other person was setting up a gag. So I remember with Jane Seymour, when she was a guest, and she came on and I said, hello, Jane, you look very nice tonight. And she said, oh, thank you. And I said, your turn. And she said, oh, you look very nice as well. And I said, yeah, pinstripes, very slimming. And I threw that out there and I knew that Mira would pick up on it. And what she came back with was, yeah, you know, those pinstripes were a lot closer together before he put the jacket on. Which is kind of brilliant, you know. And so the difficulty for me was not laughing in character, being offended by it or something. But yeah, we'd worked on Goodness Gracious Me. That's where we met.
And so it's interesting when something develops over a period of time and obviously you're not together and then suddenly you realise that there's something there.
Flight to Australia. Yeah, it's a long flight and something's got to give. Yeah, it is interesting because in a way we were colleagues first and then we were friends for, I don't know, 8-10 years. I mean, she was with someone else, I was with someone else, and so yeah, it was a long gestation period in terms of us getting together. But also when we got together, a lot of those boxes had been ticked in terms of, do we get on, are we interested in the same things, do we problem solve in the same way? But particularly, as you know, when you're working with somebody else in comedy, it can be really intense, and so problem solving within that is a great indicator.
I never married Stuart.
Didn't you?
I mean, we fucked a couple of times, but it's just to get the tension out.
Did one of you get more fucked than the other?
I think so. I think it was me. So, and you revived the Kumars, which I missed this. I am ashamed to say, but on Sky.
No, yeah, don't be ashamed. It was very short lived. Yeah, not entirely successful, actually. I mean, we had some fantastic guests and there were some great moments, but Sky decided very, very close to us making the programme that they wanted it to be an hour.
Right.
And that was... And I wish now I'd said no, but at that point I felt the pressure of kind of like, we'd got people hired and it was, let's try it at an hour. But I think, the reason that TV comedy works at a half hour is because... you can suspend comic disbelief for that long. I think that an hour, you need something else. You need a narrative, or it becomes an entertainment show or a variety show or something like that.
Sure. You had Brian Blessed on.
Brian! Do you know what? I got to ask him, I know he was on here, but I got to ask him my favourite question I asked anyone ever, which was, Brian, is it true that you once punched a polar bear in the face?
Yes, I did, yes. He poked his nose in, you see, and I punched him in the face. It was kind of, he's...
I mean, he's not of this world, is he? Didn't he go up Everest without any oxygen?
Yeah, he said, he said he's done a lot of things. he said a lot of stuff. I tuned out after a while, if I'm honest. I know you've been swatting up on the emergency questions. I know you bought the emergency questions.
I did buy it, because I wanted to be supportive.
Yeah, that's nothing.
Not revision, like you pointed out.
I'm glad someone's bought it. I'll ask one from the back of my... So just in case you have been revising. Don't want you to cheat. I've got some new ones in the back of my book. Which sense could you do without? If you had to lose one sense, which sense would you lose?
God, I'd lose the sixth one I've got. I'd keep the other five.
Good
mind reading. I'd lose that one.
That's not fair. You knew that was coming.
So I knew you were going to say that.
Thank you. Have you ever met Prince Andrew?
No, I haven't. I've seen him. I've seen him.
Lurking around, doing the stuff he does.
Yeah, you know, doing
don't need to go into
Prince Andy stuff.
When did you see him?
This is going to sound very name-droppy. it was at Prince Charles's wedding.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Me and Mira got invited to Prince Charles's wedding to Camilla. Not the first wedding, I should have pointed out.
It's been pretty impressive you've been at that one.
Yeah, I know. If I had been, I would have been cleaning up afterwards. times have changed. We've all moved on. Equal respect, equal opportunities. I think the entire royal family were there. So they sort of walked. We were in the church at St. George's Chapel or whatever it is in Windsor. And, they all walked past. So I saw Prince Andrew.
What was he up to, anything?
Couldn't see his hands.
No, okay. So he's probably all right.
Yeah.
Probably all right.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And let's see, what else have I got? Oh, this is a question that usually gets asked to women in the Daily Express that I've decided to only ask my male guests.
Oh, yeah.
What's your beauty secret?
Oh, gosh, that's a good one, isn't it? My beauty secret is just agree with your missus. Because the thing is that, you know, because if your missus hits you, they know how to hit you without the bruises showing. So, but then you walk funny. And so, you know, to avoid that whole thing of walking funny and people going, why are you walking funny? It's that's my beauty tip.
Okay, that's good. Yeah.
And hair dye.
So you've become quite a serious... You've moved over into serious acting. I'm always suspicious of the comedians moving away from comedy.
It usually comes from the comedians who... can't
but it's joking. I saw an interview when you were doing Spamalot, which I want to talk to you about as well, but saying that you're not necessarily getting offered those leading man parts and you're not getting offered serious parts very much, so obviously that's changed since that was about 10 years ago 7 8 years ago
probably. Yes, that's right. I'm not a leading man anyway.
We're both of a similar stature.
We are.
A similar height.
We are.
And that
not dissimilar age.
No. So that means, that often sometimes...
If I'm a leading man, that means...
That I could be.
Yeah. Mm. And if you're not a leading man, that means I probably am not. I'm not. I'm not a leading man in that kind of sense at all. I mean, I think that... do you know what? I don't approach drama any differently to comedy. I think that was... With Unforgotten, which is a series I have been doing, I got asked that question a lot, actually, which was, the comedy to drama thing. And I said, I don't approach it any differently because you're playing a character, and then either funny shit happens to them or serious shit happens to them. The only difference, and then when I was talking to them, I said, the difference is comedy is much more technical because, comedy can come from, obviously, a punchline, or It can come from a word, or it can come from a pause. But if it comes from a pause, if the pause is too short, not funny. Too long, not funny. There's a sweet spot on the pause. And you don't have that with drama. And also, comedy requires a very specific reaction, which drama doesn't. You know, people had to wail to let you know that the drama had worked in a different kind of beast. But I then thought, actually, comedy is just harder. It is harder.
Yeah. Well, a lot of actors say that. A lot say, "Oh, I wish I could do comedy. I wish I could be." You know, you've worked with amazing actors, but you know, you're talking to these actors that occasionally come across. Think, "Oh, to do stand up comedy, that must be amazingly difficult." And you go, "But you know, you've done Shakespeare and these harrowing roles, and they do feel that." But it's sort of weird the way comedy gets treated as certainly in award terms and things like that, it gets treated as a lesser thing.
Yeah, it's a poor cousin, isn't it?
Yeah.
It always has been. No, I think that's ridiculous. I mean, it's kind of, with the Oscars particularly, they always pointed out there that there's very few comedy films that have kind of, and you think about the great comedy films. I mean, for me, it's, you know, Some Like It Hot or Spinal Tap or, you know, any of those things. The two of the three Python films, I think, are genius.
Yeah.
And they're not going to get anywhere close to it. I mean, but I think BAFTAs are slightly better than the Oscars. I remember Fish Called Wanda won a few. Michael Palin won, and I think John Cleese won something for that. Might have won Best Film. But it is rare. It's very rare. And, I think, you know what? It's that weird thing. Did you ever get this? Particularly when you were on TV.
All right.
What? And then radio. That thing of people coming up to you and going... Yeah, my mate's funnier than you. You got my
cousin. They never did because
they weren't.
They weren't. They knew. I mean, but I also think that's true. You know, it is true that like sometimes people's mates are funnier than you.
I would always say they probably are. Yeah. I don't know them.
But you know, there's lots of funny people in the world, and actually, it's not. You know, it's not the ability to be funny in the pub that makes you a good comedian.
That's it.
It's all the work involved, except for you, where you just do a gig and someone comes along and says, "Here's the TV show."
Yeah.
But no, you've got
positive discrimination gone mad.
But no, even for what you're talking about, you know, the amount you're putting in, the thing you're saying is true. That comedy is the same effort as it's just acting, and it's about truth. So even though the Kumars, you know, it's hyper real, it's not a real situation. But you've got to believe and act that situation exactly as if it are true within that, just as if you're doing a serious police forensic drama. You've got to get into that character and be true.
Yeah, that's true. But I think comedy is harder because it is more technical.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are adept at it, and that's great because they've just got a natural kind of affinity for it, and they can perform it and present it, and that's brilliant. But you've got fantastic comedy writers who are not particularly great on stage, and, you know, that's another skill. But I think it's a very... I agree with you. I think it's a really underrated skill as well. But in the same way that... You know, actors as well. I mean, you wouldn't go to see a concert, for instance, and see someone play, I don't know, Rachmaninoff, or, you know, back in the day, see Oscar Peterson playing jazz and come out and go, "I could do that." Shit, I could do that. With actors, people do. They come out of a cinema and they go, "I'm better than him."
Yeah.
And with comedians, it's even more so.
It is. And I think it's easy to do that. It's easy with both, because you think, "Oh, it looks easy, and like, I can tell a joke, and I can pull a stupid, I can pull a serious face." But when you start working with great actors, you really see the difference and the craft in it. And, you know, I think...
But also, because I think, you know, it's an intangible skill. I mean, until someone actually gets up on a stage and performs to an audience and tries to connect with an audience, it's just an abstract thing, you know. I think it's... whereas a musical skill, for instance, is very tangible.
Yes.
You know, it's...
And doing accents, that's just a tangible skill I have.
Yeah, you're all gifted that way, actually. Did you have to work on them, or did you...
No, I just think, what's a Welsh person like? And what's an Indian person like? It's the same. What's a Scottish person like? Just a bit colder. And eating a bit less seaweed, and then it's there. Bang, it's gone. So, you crop up in... I was watching Notting Hill the other day, and I kind of have this love-hate thing with Richard Curtis, and I think he's an amazing writer, but some of the films are... Notting Hill's actually... you know, slightly, maybe the only ethnic person in Notting Hill, aren't you? but you crop up in the restaurant with.
Yeah, I think it was Angry Man at restaurant number 3,
right.
I think, which is my film debut.
Was it the first one you were in? It was great.
Yeah, and it was exciting to be on a film set, but also I was doing a scene with Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant.
Yes.
And I remember we read through the scene beforehand. So, and Julia Roberts kind of said, I said, oh, it's fine, I'll stand, because there weren't enough seats. And she said, no, I'll move here and you can sit here. And I sat down and a seat was still warm. And I thought, has she farted on it? And then I thought, can there be transference of DNA from this to, can I, if I, you know, suck it in, could it be DNA? Can you get DNA from a fart? You must be able to, right?
Yeah.
If you can get it from breath.
Yeah. They've caught a lot of criminals because they've farted in the sea.
That fart database.
Yeah. It's just a bloke smelling. Fart. Yeah, I know that one.
The Farting Bureau of Investigation.
I tell you who doesn't do that job, Rick Edwards. Was she nice, Julia Roberts? Would you say if she wasn't nice?
I would say if she wasn't nice. Yeah. She was nice. Yeah, yeah, she was very, you know, a little bit withdrawn. She wasn't kind of, she was very polite and she was very warm and stuff. Whereas Hugh Grant was very engaging and smiley and I did Paddington 2 with him.
Yes.
And he was, in which he was fantastic.
Well, actually, it's an awesome film. So that's what I mean. Paddington 2, I know it surely has won lots of awards, but that's such an awesome film.
Because yeah,
it's a comedy in a kids' show, kids' film, it might be like, oh, you know, it's Paddington 2. But genuinely, one of the most entertaining films I've ever seen.
Yeah, do you know, I would agree. And it's kind of, and I thought the first one was brilliant as well.
Yes, it was,
But Hugh Grant in it was, he was unshackled.
Yeah.
And he did some of the best improvising I have ever seen in my life.
Right.
A lot of which got cut because they moved scenes around. But he was just in the zone. And it was, because he started off in comedy. You know, he was in a comedy trio, I think.
That's right, yeah.
It started. Jockeys of Norfolk.
That's it, Jockeys of Norfolk. Yeah, well done.
So he started in comedy, and he was brilliant in it. But yeah, he was really fun, and he was engaging and stuff. And Julia was a little bit more Julia, like I know her.
Yeah.
I remember going on an Asian program at the time. I thought it was stupid. I was in one scene and Angry Man in restaurant number 3. I don't even have a bloody name. And I went on to plug it. And the first thing I said, look, I just want to quash the rumours about the affair that me and Julia Roberts are having. And she went, what affair? And I said, the rumours I'm trying to start now. I just want to quash the rumour I'm trying to start about having an affair. But she's very warm and she's very striking.
It's a weird film.
Notting Hill?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, why is she interested in him and what's going on? She's horrible. She's horrible to him all the way through.
She's Julia Roberts.
But that's, you know.
Yeah, but you say that now. But
I say that having dated some actresses. I know Hugh Grant's character is going to get shafted in that film. But, but this is what happens in a lot of Richard Curtis's stuff. There's this kind of romantic ideal of love sort of springing up from nowhere. And there's no, you know, this is not.
You want the sorry reality of your own life reflected back to you. Like you haven't had enough.
I want Julia Roberts to realise Hugh Grant isn't all that good and then come over to Balham, where I was living at the time. The film should be called Balham. If she's just going to hook up with anyone who just bumps into her in a fucking bookshop. I might have some issues of my own there, but it's a good scene. It's a good scene, the restaurant scene. When you were sitting in that restaurant, did any of the other cast come up to you and say,
Should we go for an English? It was before it had to be. I think, goodness gracious me, hadn't gone out
really?
At that point.
Okay.
Yeah. Although I did learn something in that scene about continuity, which was so we were at a Japanese restaurant, and so they put out this plate of sushi, and I thought, oh, fantastic, this is great. And I thought, that prawn looks fantastic. I'm going to save that prawn till the end. I'm going to have that manky bit of tuna first so I can get that out of the way. And, of course, we shot the scene, and they say, cut, and they come back, they give you another plate, and they go, make sure you eat the tuna, because we've already got a shot of you. So for 4 hours, it was manky tuna.
Looking at the prawn.
Oh, the prawn was taunting me.
You're the Chancellor of Sussex University.
I am, yeah.
How's that?
Do you want a degree?
Yeah, please.
Sorted. That's how it works. Yeah, that was bizarre. I followed Lord Attenborough, who was right. Chancellor there for 10 years. Do you know what? They contacted me and said, you know, how would you feel about being Chancellor? And I said, yeah, great. I said, you're not going to choose me, but God, what an honour to be asked. And then I said, look, you know, I got rejected by the University of Sussex when I played. It was my first choice, and they rejected me.
Really?
And so I tell the students that every degree ceremony. I say, you never know how the future's going to turn out. Because I said, you know, look, I didn't get in there, and I was really disappointed. And now, you know, you bastards, I've come in, and I'm in charge.
I'd have gone in and fucked the place up. Right, and the chancellor, I'm like, I should start throwing things around. You fuckers! I wasn't good enough for you before. Oh, why do you like me now? I wouldn't have been chancellor for very long, but it would have been a great day.
Can you imagine attempting to do a dirty protest across an entire campus? I mean, you know, one small room. You watch these documentaries and they go, God, it was a dirty protest in his cell. And you go, God, how long did that take? I mean, that can't be one shit, can it? I mean, that's got to be... Wait, and did it? Nobody check in between and go, he's shitting on the walls.
And the chancellor! There we go.
Be good. Student union, bah!
And so your parents came over from India, but you did a show about going back to India because of the partition, right?
It was I like to call it a documentary.
Yeah, sorry.
it makes it sound a little more highbrow than it. We opened with a song.
Musical.
To Ronnie's parody of partition. Yeah, I did, it was a doc series that I did. It was India at 60 years of independence, so it was about 10, 11 years ago. I kind of went round India and retraced my dad's steps in kind of, you know, who the fuck do you think you are kind of manner. So crossed into Pakistan because they were both born in what is now Pakistan. And then at partition in 1947, they had to move as refugees. And my mum got out slightly earlier. My dad was slightly later. And he ended up in a refugee camp in Delhi. And... it was that thing you left with whatever you could carry.
Right.
And in a way, this is the interesting thing about partition in terms of the ripple effect of it, is that obviously it created, you know, three new countries in the region, India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, two of which now have nuclear weapons, which is wasn't a great forward planning thing. But also a lot of those people who'd been displaced, like my parents, I mean, there was over 1 million people that died. It's the largest exodus in history, so it's over 15 million people had to move with only a few weeks' notice as to where the border was going to come down. And it's not then surprising that a lot of those people who were displaced are the ones who then kind of emigrated to Britain, to Canada, and to America. Mm. And so my dad was part of this. So my dad came to Britain in 1956, so he was kind of fairly early, an early adopter. And my mum, 1960.
Right. Did they meet in the UK then, presumably?
The weird thing is that they met in India, but my dad's older brother was married to my mum's older sister. So we always, my sister and I used to say, of course, it was the Cut Price Indian musical, Two Brides for Two Brothers. So they kind of knew each other beforehand.
Yeah. And so I'm sort of interested in how things are going now compared to how things were going then.
With my parents, they're very happy. They've stuck it out. And,
good. For immigrants to this country and people and the children of immigrants, because it felt like we were progressing forwards, hopefully. I mean, I'm presuming your parents maybe encountered some difficulties when they got here.
Yeah, I mean, my earliest memory is 2.5, and so I've got fairly vivid memories from sort of 3 onwards. And so I kind of remember what they went through. And so, you know, them attempting to protect me from it all, you know, with the best intentions didn't work because I clocked everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had that thing of, so we lived above a laundrette in Hounslow in Middlesex, west of London. And I remember my parents having to paint over swastikas painted on their front door and packies out and all this kind of stuff. And in a way, the weird thing about the 70s, if you lived through the 70s with the amount, particularly with racism and sexism and everything else, is that you kind of, it's not that you got used to it, but it kind of toughened you up in a slightly different way. So you, for me now, when I see kind of, you know, the stuff that goes on social media particularly, it's, I'm less affected by the name calling, you know, it's because I've lived through that and I saw worse than that. And so in a way, it's not a defining badge for me, which I think it is for a lot of people who are younger. Mm-hmm. Do you see that on, you see it on Twitter sometimes?
If people
take huge offense at being called a name, and I kind of go, yeah, it's kind of like, it's a bunch of letters that form a word. It's kind of like, I mean, I remember my mum saying to me when I was a kid, that, you know, an insult is only an insult once you've accepted it as one.
Yeah.
Up until that point, it isn't.
Yeah.
You know, and so so I grew up with that. But we had, you know, we had the National Front recruiting outside our school. And so the only person they ever recruited was a Sikh kid. seriously, there's Juggy. And because they wouldn't get anyone. We had about a third. About a third of our school was Asian. And Juggy just misunderstood repatriation. And he said, what do they mean by repatriation? We said, well, they'll pay for you to go home. And he said, what? Hounslow. And we said, if that's where you live, that's where it'll be. And he said, what, the bus fare? Or we said, yep, the bus fare. So he went up to this guy and said, you want to send me home? And he went, yeah. And he said, okay, I'll sign up. He said, do I get it now or do I get it? When do I get it? 30p. When do I get it? And the guy just looked really confused. Yeah. It's the only person ever they recruited.
And do you think we're heading backwards or forwards within this? Do you think it's...
Well, Richard, that is a very big question indeed that you've asked. You want an answer. Yeah. I see. That's why you asked the question. That's how questions and answers work. I think, you know, broadly, we've moved forward. But I think, you know, the same thing applies to sexism and ageism and everything else, which is that... So I've been doing a... I don't know if I'm supposed to kind of talk about this or not, so I will. So there's a doc series that the BBC are doing, and I'm doing one part of it. And I was looking at activists. And so the episode that I'm doing, I'm interviewing people about Martin Luther King. Who is it? Helen Keller, blind and deaf Helen Keller. Emmeline Pankhurst and Gandhi. And the interesting thing about talking to people who knew... particularly Helen Keller and Martin Luther King, because they both died in 1968, was I kind of asked the question, what would they think about, you know, the situation now? And with all of them, with Gandhi, with Emmeline Pankhurst as well, was that everybody kind of said they'd be slightly depressed. Nice. Because the thing is that they made such huge strides at that point.
Yeah.
That, you know, if you got votes for women in sort of 1930 was when they got votes for some women, you would have thought, yeah, within the next 20 years, yeah, women will have the vote. They'll be equal. And then you kind of go now, and things like equal pay and stuff like that is still a really, really big issue. So I think that we have generally moved forward because also, I mean, I'm stunned at how, you know, the shift to the right that the world has made in the last few years. I mean, I just don't get it. You know, you get someone like the President of the United States who's fact-checked on a daily basis, and you got people going, that's 30 lies today. There was another 30 lies today, another 10 lies today. And you go, and all these people are kind of going, no, that's the person we're backing. And you know, with that kind of attitude, that is the danger, because you kind of go, he in particular, but, you know, and people who love him and think he's great, think that behavior is fine. So, you know, his attitude towards whether it's women, whether it's kind of ethnic minorities, well, everyone except him and his family, basically, is kind of justified in some way, and it enables a load of people. The one thing that I think is hopeful, and where I do think we've kind of moved on, is that there is a strong kind of counter voice to that. And in the 70s, you had kind of, you know, the anti-fascist kind of like brigades that would turn up to all the NF things. And I think now with online and the rest of it, I think it's just as powerful. And I think that, you know, we just, you know, Remembrance Day wasn't that long ago. And it was, you kind of go, all those people in those wars died for an ideal. And then you look at the ideals that people are chasing now and you go, has that just bypassed you, all that stuff?
Well, there's people wearing poppies and swastikas you know, that's doing Nazi. Is that
hedging your bets?
I think it's a slight misunderstanding.
I'm not sure how this is going to turn out. So, so yeah, I think overall we have, but yeah. I think that, you know, that counter voice, I think, is really important, because I think, you know, it's the centre that gets squeezed out, and so you just get extremes that are shouting at each other over your head. And so, you know, that counter voice of kind of, which is reasonable and reasoning, I think is really important. I do see a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. Bloody Nazis.
Yeah.
Ooh, those guys.
Honestly.
Let's give them another try and see how they do this time. That's what I say.
But the weird thing is, you kind of go, because I did marketing, right? So, you know, Nazism in the Hitler fashion, not now, the twats now, the one, got no dress sense at all. But at that time, the whole styling of that thing was really clever.
Yeah.
You know, the Leni Riefenstahl kind of films and, you know, the uniforms. I mean, everything was, it was kind of well thought out. It's a famous designer, wasn't it, who designed the, was it the SS uniforms? Or the
Hugo Boss, was it? I mean, I don't want to slander Hugo Boss.
Does anybody know
He's a cunt, though. So,
yeah, it was Hugo Boss.
It was Hugo Boss.
Yeah, yeah.
And Volkswagen. Ian Volkswagen. He made the Volkswagen. Yeah, there were, you know, there was a lot going for him. You taught me around to Nazism. Well, before I met you, I was thinking the Nazis weren't all that great. But now the marketing...
You want to take the Nazis and you go, look, I don't give a shit about all that stuff. You go, what clothes do you think you'd be wearing? Nice. All right. Turnips are back.
So let's, we'll move on from that, but thank you for sharing that. Let's talk about Monty Python. You've worked with and know most of the, all of the Monty Python guys, the living ones.
Yeah, the living ones. Yeah, I've met them all. I've worked with three of them. Oh, no, I've worked with all of them. Yeah, the ones that are living, yeah. And I'm friends with three of them. Do you know what? It's really weird, Richard. It's really odd. sorry to name drop again. I apologise in advance. Not really. otherwise, I just wouldn't say it, would I? Something I genuinely find sort of really rooting and quite humbling is that when I think about my journey, right, and I don't know if you reflect on yours, you do when you have kids, don't you?
A little bit,
go,
yeah.
Wow, look, well, you've got a kid now, and this is amazing. And is that I think about the posters I had on my wall when I was 15, and I had the Python, so they were there. There was a Life of Brian poster I had. I had one of James Bond. I had Roger Moore, James Bond, then I had Clint Eastwood and James Dean, and Animal from the Muppets. I had a Laurel and Hardy, and Elvis, Beatles.
You've worked with all of them since.
Do you know what? It's that weird thing. I met three of the Beatles.
Yeah.
What's strange is I kind of go, you know, I'm friends with some of these people now. Yeah. And that's really strange. I mean, so with some of the Pythons, and Roger Moore I became friends with, which was bizarre and wonderful. And it's like they've stepped off my 15-year-old wall. When nothing was going for me, and I thought, I'm never going to do the stuff that... all this stuff that I'm interested in, I'll never end up doing that. And that's a really weird and warm moment, actually. Can I tell you something about Roger Moore?
Yes, please do.
One of the funniest things, he was really, really funny, a very supportive guy. And I said to Roger once, I said, Roger, have I ever told you that Live and Let Die was the first Bond film I ever went to see at the cinema? And he shook his head. And I said, I was 9 or 10 years old. And I said, that's the first Bond film. And I said, in those days, you had continuous programming. So when they showed the film, they'd wait 15 minutes and then they'd start running the film again. And I said, so the film finished. And I thought, yeah, I'll watch the beginning. Beginning was great. I'll watch another half an hour. That'd be great. I'll watch an hour. That's great. I said, Roger, I watched the whole thing twice. Sat there, watched the whole thing twice. And he paused for about 2 seconds and he said, you owe me £4.50. There was another time, and I'd written a book, and I'd got him to sign his book to me, and I said, is it okay if I give you my book, and I'll sign it to you? And he said, yeah, and I put to Hamara, Roger Moore, and Hamara in Hindi means hour, because when I was a kid, my mum used to go the equivalent of hour, Roger Moore's on the telly, and the whole family get together and watch Roger Moore. And so I put Hamara, Roger Moore. And I said, maybe I should explain what Hamara means. And he said, may I hazard a guess? And I said, yeah, sure, Roger. He said, I'm guessing shithead. I said, Roger, I know you did Octopussy. I never realised you were fluent in Hindi. That's absolutely extraordinary.
but you did Spamalot, and you were King Arthur in Spamalot, which was...
Yeah, that was bonkers as well, wasn't it?
It was great, but what an amazing thing to happen. To end up being in the play of that film that presumably you watched as a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And loved. But then also to be King Arthur as well and... be Asian King Arthur, which is
well
wonderful.
That was the thing, that was the weird thing, was I went to the audition, as my agent said, they want you to audition for King Arthur in Spamalot, and I said, well, they're not going to give it to me, but I've never been to a musical audition before, so let me go along and see what happens, because I had no idea. So I went along and you had to, you know, sing a couple of songs and do some of the lines, so I did that, and then about a week or two later my agent said, you've got the job. And and I thought, oh, my God. And I looked at the script properly. And, yeah, all those lines from Holy Grail that you used to do in the playground, you know, all that, the night, it's, you know, it's only a flesh wound. And singing, you know, always look on the bright side of life every night was extraordinary. And then the poster was me, my face, on a Union Jack, behind a Union Jack. Oh, in front of a Union Jack, behind a Union Jack. That's it. It's a shit poster, and I've never forgiven them for it. But I remember a lot of people kind of said to me at the time, they said, well, you know, Asian King Arthur. And I said, well, it's actually King Art, like Art Malik. And I said, if you needed your horse shoeing at 3 o'clock in the morning, where else were you going to go? It was in the Asian shop that was open. But I did say, look, you know, if people are thinking about my ethnicity when they leave, then I haven't done my job. Then they haven't bought into the character. So that was really interesting to kind of then... just make the audience believe that it was a character that, you know, that wasn't as good as, you know, Graham Chapman, which is what everyone thinks when they go and see it.
Well, I mean, it's a bizarre choice. I've not actually seen Spamalot, but it's an interesting choice from Eric Idle to make some more money, which he seems to like to do. But, you know, but people love that film, and it is a brilliant, brilliant film, and there's so many... We watched it again... I mean, I've watched it so many times. It's on Netflix, and we watched quite a lot of the Monty Python stuff on Netflix recently, and, you know, loads of it stands up. And Brian and Grail really stand up.
Yeah, I think they really do. I mean, the interesting thing about Life of Brian is I don't think it would get made now.
No.
But actually what it says about religion and politics is absolutely, you know, still apt and true and real.
Yeah.
And Holy Grail is just, it's that brilliant thing that, actually I think Richard Curtis does really well, which is it's a series of sketches that are linked with a narrative. I mean,
yes,
with
yeah.
Python, they gave up on the narrative at the end of Holy Grail. But they're brilliant, brilliant sketches. The witch scene is fantastically well written.
Yes, yeah.
You know, so yeah, those were the influences anyway.
Yeah.
But what were your influences?
Well, we're very similar. I mean, you know, all the things you've said are the things that I like as well. So I liked, I was Rick Mayo, maybe because I was I'm a touch younger than you, but I'm sure you were into the young ones and... I mean, it was Python and Not That It's Not News, but then the young ones were really the big thing for me because it felt like my generation, whereas Python was always like a thing that was sort of there but you couldn't touch in a way because it was either it was Life of Brian was like a PG and I wasn't allowed to go and see it, although we did in the end, or the TV series wasn't repeated, you know. So if you weren't there, I think there was one, they repeated some of it at one point, but it was still late at night and I wasn't able to...
It was
to
late at night, yeah.
Wasn't really...
Was there ever a film that you sneaked into, underage?
Yeah, loads of things. I went to see Kentucky Fried Movie, which
that,
was...
I went to see that,
which was on a double bill with The Other Cinderella, which was a very... I've got the poster of it. Paul Putner, he was in our stuff, found the poster of this double bill, the Kentucky Fried Movie, which was the Zucker Brothers' sort of precursor to Airplane. Slightly sexy stuff in it, but mainly really kind of... Well,
there was a big End of the Dragon kind of...
there was a big End of the Dragon parody. There was some great stuff in it, and there was some slightly weirdly racist and weirdly, you know, booby... Girls with their boobs out being in showers, which I did not enjoy.
No.
Because I was a feminist. And then...
How is this essential to the plot?
And then The Other Cinderella was the Cinderella story told in a soft porn film. And I was 14, And me and my 14-year-old friends all went to see it, and it was an 18, an X certificate as it would be then. And we decided to go in the order we thought we'd get in. So we didn't send the least likely person in first, we sent the most likely person in first, which just is typical, isn't it? So if we'd not all got in, we'd have just left the straggler.
And what was that based on?
Well, based on who we thought looked the oldest and the tallest. So Phil Fry, who was the oldest, actually looked the youngest. He was a real baby face. He still is. He's 52 years old and there's a baby face. And he was quite small, so he was last, and I think I might have been second last, and the taller ones went in first. And the woman let four of us in, and then she went, "Oh no, not you! You're too young." And we went, "No, he's 18." He said, "No, he's 18." We basically did the Monty Python in unbroken voices.
But did you kind of like dress up or make yourself look old?
I don't think we really did. I think we knew there was a good chance we'd get in. I think I seem to remember once going to like an X film and asking for a half. Which obviously
half of what?
It's a big mistake because you're saying, "Yeah, but I'm only 14. Oh yeah, so I'm not allowed in. But yeah, they basically, the Wells Odeon, it's not there anymore. They'd let children in to see porn films. It was fine. It was a different time. It was fine, but it was very exciting watching the other Cinderella with my friends all sitting with erections in a row. Yeah.
Did you do that thing of sort of looking at, avoiding eye contact?
Yes,
or giggling?
Yeah.
Or
I think there was a bit of giggling. All I remember, my main thing I remember is like a Somerset man at the back of probably a 15-year-old. It was probably, is the Monty Python sketch where everyone in the cinema was probably little boys dressed up as men. And there was a scene where a bloke just went in, "Pert nipples!" And I mean, I can still say that to my friends and we'll still laugh. "Pert nipples! Pert nipples!"
That was before the loop system was
yeah,
was
well, I don't know, maybe we could have stayed in. But, you know, it was a long, old hall. I mean, Kentucky Fried Movie is a decent enough comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
The other Cinderella, I wouldn't necessarily... I mean, there's better things online now if you want to masturbate to hardcore pornography, which I do not want to.
Although the whole thing about porn films and puns still persists, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That's the whole thing of... Yeah. The Cinderella and shaving Ryan's privates and, you know, yeah. All that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it does a little bit. But it's kind of slight. There was a charming old world.
Of perversion.
It was a happier time, wasn't it? Where just pornography was just a woman touching another woman's breast and we left it at that and that was enough.
Somerset in the 70s.
Yeah. So, yeah, we did. And I did get into... And I don't know if my parents just... turned a blind eye. My parents were quite strict. They didn't want me to go and see Life of Brian. I had all the albums, the LPs of the Monty Python stuff, and I wasn't allowed to go, you know. So I'd heard it all, and I'd got the book, and I'd learnt it all off by heart.
But did they not want you to go because of the religious overtones, or because...
A little bit, but I think also because it was a PG or whatever it was. It was different all over the country. It was banned in some places, and some places it was an X, and some places it was a 14, and I think it was probably just under...
Yeah, I think it was banned... Was it banned in Norway? And I think Sweden then...
And, like, some places in England as well, and Wales.
Towns. Yeah, exactly. There was one, I think, that only lifted the ban about 10 years ago.
That's right, yeah.
But I think, I can't remember which way around it was, and maybe somebody can correct me, but I think Sweden kind of did show it, and they advertised it as the film So Funny That It Was Banned by Norway.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
They were just next door.
And
Ireland, I think, banned it, which is understandable, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And the Vatican.
Yeah.
The Vatican probably didn't ban it. It was probably on a double bill with...
It's an amazing film.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It is brilliant. Has everyone seen it?
Of course they have. Bloody comedy nerds. Not like you and me.
No, I know.
We're above that. Talking about Monty Python's Life, Brian, for 40 minutes at the end of this podcast. Anyway, hey, look, we're going to have to wrap up. There's lots of things I want to talk to you about. Thomas and Friends coming up. Is that out yet? Are you playing an engine in Thomas?
I have no idea. I've done the voice. No idea. But it's really interesting. The Thomas world is... It's out there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of... Because people, again, tweeted me and said, you know, well done on voicing Shankar, the Indian engine.
Accent quite offensive.
Well...
Yeah, what you just said there was very offensive.
From Pontypridd.
Oh, that's fair. That's fine. Now it's fine.
Yeah, thank you. Should have clarified. These are older... Thomas the Tank Engine enthusiasts from all over the world. I mean, I had no idea this world existed, but it does.
Yeah, and they've broadened. There's trains from all over the world. Now, is Thomas, do you know what's happening? Is Thomas travelling around the world and meeting trains from other lands and finding out they're okay?
Yes, I think that Thomas...
Except in Germany, where it's a bit weird.
Thomas and his friends go to different countries and introduce civilization and basically take those countries over and show them how to play cricket.
They live in Sodor, don't they? Thomas Tank Engine's from Sodor.
Well, Sodor.
Sodor! That's a funny little reverend man, didn't it, was who did that? Anyway, yes, there was something I was going to... Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you if this is true about your father. Did your mother find your father, when you were in your cot, whispering into your ear, I want to be a businessman?
Yes, he did. The two... My dad adopted subliminal marketing techniques way before they were popular. Yeah, the two things that I do remember from that, I don't remember that one because I was in the cot. Although I could have been a cot at 35. Yeah. But as I was once, that was Cuba. Anyway, it was a memorable holiday. But it was my dad. My mum found my dad saying, yeah, I want to be a businessman. The other thing was when I was about 5 or 6 or something, I remember an uncle who said, so what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, actor. And my dad said, it's pronounced doctor. And which my dad then denied. And luckily my mum said, no, he did say that.
Are they proud of you, your parents?
No, because I'm not a doctor. I'm an honorary doctor.
You are, and you're a businessman, really. I mean, come on.
Well,
your business is you.
Yeah, everyone's business is them. I mean, I'm a chancellor.
Yeah, chancellor.
But not in the German sense. Yet. She's given it up, so could be in there. Ich spreche Deutsch.
Good.
Ein bisschen. That's enough to make me run. But, do you know what? I feel really, really fortunate that given, how late it was when I started and stuff, I'm really, really grateful that my parents were still around. To have seen it.
Because
the thing is that I think for them, particularly having moved, emigrated here, and it was difficult for them. The loneliness alone was difficult when they first moved. And aside from the fact that you couldn't get black pepper when I was a kid. Right. You couldn't get it. It was white pepper was everywhere. It's not a racist thing. It's just kind of like, it's a taste thing. But, it's still in CAFs. There are CAFs. That's the only place I see white pepper now is
in
CAFs. I don't see them anywhere else. So I think they found it very, very difficult. But, one of the things I think as a parent, as a fellow parent, is that ultimately you want to know that you did a good job, unless you're Fritzl. And then the rules obviously don't apply. But, you want to know that you've kind of done a good job. You brought your kids up well and they'd be healthy, safe, whatever it is. And I think that that was the thing. I think at 30... I think they were thinking, what have we done? We've kind of like, he's not doing anything and he's going nowhere. And that's one of the things I think I'm most grateful for, is that they're, and they are, they're still about. And
that's great,
which is lovely, yeah.
That's fantastic. Well, look, it's been just such an honour to talk to you. You're a wonderful man, you're a fantastic actor.
Thank you very
much. Do comedy, and I'm sure you will, and do your serious acting as well. And ladies and gentlemen, Sanjeev Bhaskar! Give it up! You have been listening to Rich Tang, the Square Theatre Podcast, with me, Rich Tang, and my guest, Sanjeev Bhaskar. The music is by Pest. And also, can I tell you that the people I want to thank, the people at the British Comedy Guide and the people at the Leicester Square Theatre and Go Past the Stripe and everyone for just making my dreams come true, letting me do my own little interview show on the internet. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. I would just like to thank my executive producer, Matt Fouke. Oh, come on, Matt Fouke, F-U-K-E. You're having a laugh, mate. Matt Fuck is what he wants to be called, and that is what he is going to be called. He's a great guy, though. He's a brilliant executive producer. This is a GoFasterStripe.com, SkyPotato.com, Fuzz.com production.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.